welcome to Base Camp for Men. I'm your host, Tony Rezac. This is the show that gives you insights and resources on how to live a more courageous life. We'll be looking at men, the current state of masculinity, and how to create a more inspiring narrative for all men. Welcome, and let's get started. Hello, Base Campers. I hope you're all doing well. Today's episode is a special one for me as I get to speak with someone very well-versed in depth psychology and the way of the soul. To me, these interviews have a timeless quality to them as my guest and I talk about life's most important questions and how brave and sensitive souls might go about navigating these questions and finding a true path for themselves. We seem to be in the midst of a profound collective identity crisis, and I believe it is a calling back to soul itself that will most help humanity emerge with new perspectives, new life, and a renewed sense of vitality and purpose. Turbulent times seem to guide and prod us to find our deepest resources within. Before we get to our excellent guest, I want to read you a passage from one of his 19 books. He says, quote, "As children, we suffer the wounds of too muchness or not enoughness, feeling overwhelmed or abandoned, and wind up adapting our souls to protect our wounds. What a difference it would make in the life of the child and of the whole world if the parent could repeatedly and sincerely say, 'You are brought into life by nature having all you need. You have a great force, a great spirit, a great energy within. Trust it, stay in contact with it, and it will always lead you towards what is right for you,'" unquote. Profound words from a very wise man. Enjoy the interview. Today's episode is brought to you by Stand Up Now Apparel. Stand Up Now has amazing designs centered on God, family, freedom, and patriotism. They use only the softest cotton in their designs and have gear for the whole family. There's something for everyone, Base Campers. I know you're going to love their products. Go support them at www.standupnowapparel.com and use the code BASECAMP to receive a 10% discount and free shipping. And now, on to our interview. My guest today is renowned author and teacher, Dr. James Hollis. Dr. Hollis is the author of 19 books, soon to be 20, and is a Washington, D.C.-based Jungian analyst and speaker. Here is my interview with Dr. James Hollis. All right, I am here with Dr. James Hollis, prolific author, longtime professor, grandfather. Dr. Hollis, Jim, welcome to Base Camp for Men. It is great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, you know, how many books have you read now? Is it like 16, 17?
Well, the 20th is at the printer, so I'm kind of like a serial killer, I guess. I keep each one's the last one, and then this strange urge comes over me, and next thing I know, another birth is in the channel, so to speak. So
you say you have grandchildren. Each one of these must feel a little bit like a grandchild or a child, right?
It is a child of sorts, yes.
Yeah, you know, you're a really longtime professor, have taught Jungian thought and depth psychology and humanities for a long time. When was the first time you got bitten by the kind of the mythology, you know, that whole world that called to you and became your life's work? Like, were you a high school student? Did it happen in college? Like, where did you first kind of go, oh man, there's some magic here, and really call your attention out onto your life's path? And maybe what was that book or books that first did the trick for you?
Well, you know, I think long before that, as a child, as someone between 5 and 10 years old, I remember having very large questions, you know, what's this life about? What's the world about? I was a child during World War II, so I was immensely influenced by, while perfectly safe myself in America's Midlands, I also knew there was a lot of suffering going on and huge events. And so for me, the big question started as a child, as I think they do for many children, but they often get lost along the way. And the truth is, those questions stuck with me all the way. And so I always felt that the issue of life, why are we here? In service to what? What's the purpose of life? Why is there suffering? Why is there evil? Why do we die? These elemental questions, I think, are with us all the time, whether we reflect upon them consciously or not. So I think the beginning was really asking those kinds of questions. And the truth is, I'm still asking those questions. I'm 84 now, so I've been asking them for a long time. But they lead us to paths of discovery, and our responses to them evolve as we evolve, of course. And you use the word mythology there. I hasten to add to our listeners that when we use the word myth here, we're not talking about falsehood. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the energies that move through nature and through us, through our bodies and through our minds and spirits, and create our values, often influence our choices, whether we're aware of it or not. And it's, to be sure, a report of the ancient traditions that interests us. And I was interested as a child in our ancestors of all kinds around the world and how they understood the human condition. And at the same time, I realized that many times their understandings, their ways of framing these questions have changed. Human nature hasn't changed very much. Mm-hmm. You know, social biologist E.O. Wilson said once that we have Paleolithic minds in medieval institutions and armed with lethal modern weapons, which is a pretty scary prospect when you think about it. Yeah. I think it's true. If one studies the ancient scriptures and mythologies, one sees that human nature hasn't changed. People are still capable of self-deception. They're still capable of seeing others through the lens of their own projections, not as they are, but as one's internal psychology construes them. People are still caught up with envy, jealousy, rage, desire, and so forth. So, whatever is universal, whatever is changeless in us, society changes, certain cultural values change, certainly technology has changed, but the human being hasn't changed very much over the last several millennia. So the real question then is, what does our human experience tell us? What are we to learn from this? And why is it that we keep seemingly making the same mistakes over and over? And so I think to answer your question, it began in childhood. It has never gone away.
That's beautiful. Love it. Yeah. You've written a few books, and you have lots of great insights on navigating middle age, right? As a passage, as an initiation. And, I gravitate towards that work, being a middle-aged guy myself. But when I was reading your book, Living Between Worlds, it kind of struck me that it seems like right now we're living through, as young as our country is here in America, it seems to me like we're having a midlife crisis right now, a collective identity crisis. And I'm very curious to get your thoughts on it, because I think no matter what your political orientation is right now, I think people they're losing trust in some of the things that maybe, 20, 30, 40 years ago were slam dunk trust, the media, or trust the authorities on your health, or whatever the, it seemed things were more solid, that we were navigating and we all had agreement on where we were, what we had to rely on. And now you're seeing that trust in our systems really crumbling. And now this isn't the first time in our history, to your point, that people have had to deal with a crumbling system and wondering what's going to come. But I wanted to ask you about that, because it seemed like when I was reading your middle age stuff, and then I turned to this kind of in between space and navigating uncertain times, there was some synchronicity, or at least some, like, I'm like, it seems like collectively we're having an identity crisis right now. And so I thought it would be a good question for you to kind of address. And, yeah, I guess I'll just hand it to you there. And what is your insight or your advice for kind of navigating these times? Because right now, everybody, I talk to people and they're just like, I have no idea what's coming right now. Like, I don't know. I think it could go this way, it could go that way. And either way, I feel like it's going to be a freak out, And so people are really dealing with this kind of, things seem to be crumbling and we don't know what's next. We don't know what, are we building the next golden age? It can be really hard to tell right now.
Well, that's a profound question, Tony, once again. And actually, I concur with you. I've actually used that analogy myself that America is going through a midlife crisis because we just look at the individual human being. You know, we set off as children, tiny, dependent, and vulnerable, but we try to assemble enough ego consciousness to leave our parents, step out into the world, and create a life of some kind. And we're sort of flush with the heroic ego. I'm going to go out there and make my way. I'm going to go out there and find the right person to marry, perhaps, and find the right career. And I'm going to have children, perhaps, and they're going to worship me, and they're going to be perfect in every way, and so forth. And then, you know, that's partly you have to have that fantasy to get out there and create a provisional life. But then meet a person between 35 and 55, and you'll have a different kind of conversation. Because by then, one will have begun to recognize limitations for the first time. One's perhaps confused. You know, I worked very hard to develop this career, and now I find it entrapping me. It's boring, etc. My relationship has all kinds of troubles in it, and so forth. And one is obliged to recognize, as you said, there are no certainties in life, and that one is going to have to go back to the drawing board. One of the things that happens in our formative years is the displacement of authority. You know, when we're infants and children, we have an authority. It's called our instinct. It tells us what we want, what is right for us. But because we have to fit into the culture around us and we have no elemental powers of our own, we have to be creatures of adaptation. And that's how we protect ourselves and fit in and so forth, get our needs met, perhaps, or at least try to. But then later in life, you realize, you know, I've either replicated the experience from which I've come, you know, I've become like my father after all, or one is spending one's life trying to get away from that. Either way, you're still being defined by that other. And you're right. In my parents' life, and certainly when I was a child, there were what I call, and I just made this word up, fixities, you know, fixed beliefs about what a man is, what a woman is, what sexual preference means, what ethnicity means, cultural values, clarity of moral systems, etc., etc. Well, World War II, the modern era, many of these ostensible fixities have been deconstructed, and we come to realize they don't really come from divinity, as people thought. My parents would have thought that. They didn't really come necessarily from nature. They're social constructs. By constructs, I mean ideas, and we try to make sense of our life with these ideas, but all ideas come from human beings, and when they are called into question or deconstructed, then you begin to realize, right? Now I have to deal with some ambiguity. And the human ego doesn't particularly like ambiguity. It prefers clarity and certainty and a certain measure of control. So the current distemper of our culture, I think, revolves around one central thing, and you've touched on this, and that's the loss of certainty, the loss of fixities. And just as the project of the second half of life for the individual is the recovery of a personal authority. That's what allows us to navigate our way through a bewildering wilderness of choices and options and limitations. So, as a culture, we have to recover a sense of our purpose and our direction, both individually and collectively. So, you know, the fault line breaks down around the issue of change, especially the rapidity of change. There are those who are frightened by that change and want to go back to an earlier era, believing it to be a better time. And frankly, I'm not convinced that it was because I was there. I have some reason to know that those, you know, definitions of what it meant to be a man were profoundly limiting and destructive to women and so forth. And the racism that was part of it, those were categories that privilege some people and disadvantaged other people, and had no ultimate basis except for a human understanding of these things, which again is subject to flaws, and to find, on the other hand, the desire for change and the desire for greater integration of disparate ideas, different people, etc., etc. And so Again, it's common for the human ego, mine and yours, to be troubled by ambiguity, except it's in ambiguity that you have the real range of choice, real capacity for renewal. Excuse me one second. And I think when we think about the anxiety that is rippling through our culture, we realize it devolves around the question of change. For some, the world's changed too much. For others, it hasn't changed enough. And coping with change is a central task of the human being, because change is going on in the bodies of all of us. Change is going on in the culture around us. Change is seen in the world. So the only constant, ironically, and this is not a new idea, you can find it in the ancient world, mm-hmm. The only constant is change. And so how one handles change is significant. So I'll give you a very personal example. As an 84-year-old, I'm dealing with significant medical issues. I'm post-surgical at this point, and I'm dealing with aging and limitations, and my wife has health issues. And so it's not a question of whether we choose to get older or not. It's a question of how we handle getting older and encroaching infirmity and so forth. And mm-hmm. How do you keep the spirit alive during those changes, and how do you find your benchmarks by which to make your choices? So mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say we are in a midlife crisis, and you know, what can come out of this is a richer experience for this culture and for individuals, but there are also regressive forces.
Sure.
So that push-pull is going on in each of us every morning.
Yeah.
I mentioned, I think, in the Middle Passage book, that every morning we waken to find at the foot of our bed, if you look carefully, two gremlins. One's called fear and one's called lethargy. And fear says, you know, this is too much for you. You can't handle it. Just chill out. And lethargy says, you know, turn on the television, have some chocolate. Tomorrow's another day.
Yeah.
They're the enemies of life. You see, whatever we have to deal with, if we can't deal with fear and lethargy, and, you know, video games and drugs and popular culture are examples of lethargy taking over, where we'd rather be entertained or lulled to sleep than have to deal with life's genuine struggles. So that's part of how one has to decide on a daily basis. What kind of person am I going to bring into my family, into my world? And how am I going to show up, not show off, but show up as a independent adult, but one who's respectful to the values of other people as well.
Yeah, that's great. You know, you mentioned lethargy, being stuck. You know, I've got a couple of episodes coming out. You know, I've been sober for 11 years, so I know addiction quite well personally, as well as in my family, and I've had a number of really great guests on talking. You know, Dr. Bob Baer has been on my show a bunch of times. And I just want to give you a chance to answer, like, why do humans stay stuck? You know, and it's funny because I think if most people were to describe me, most people that know me well, they would, you know, you might hear that he's got courage, or he's got the courage to face himself. If you talk to men in my men's group, you know, for 20 years, they would describe me in what, you know, authentic, you know, tells the truth about his inner life or whatever. Well, and the truth is, even though, let's just take my sobriety around alcohol for 11 years, I don't drink, but there's still the scared little kid, little boy in me that feels overwhelmed by what's going on and desperately wants to self-soothe. You know, I reflexively grab my phone is a good example of where that little boy runs now. And so, you know, and you had a couple of great quotes that I wanted to tee you up with. You said, quote, all addictions are anxiety management systems, unquote. And then there's another one where you said, quote, I don't know if this is your quote or you grabbed it, but it said, quote, I avoid an unacceptable experience of anxiety through this behavior, a behavior that creates its own gradually increasing problems, unquote. And I think that is a great way to describe this shadow part of ourselves that I think sometimes people think, well, if I could just stop overeating, or if I could just stop this processed addiction I have on the internet, or if I could just stop smoking cigarettes or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the part, that part of yourself really doesn't go anywhere. You're still traveling with this part of you that's maybe afraid and wants to self-soothe, or, you know, wants to just grab something to, you know, I think of it as like keeping this raw sense of being afraid or overwhelmed, or, you know, all the things that you and I have been talking about. You know, it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming not to know. And I'm not saying that from an ego point of view. It's this, there's part of my soul that's maybe like, uh-oh, what's going to happen? And one of the ways that I cope as an addict is I reach for something that is going to buffer the sense of like, uh-oh, I don't know if I'm safe here. And I'll let you grab whatever you want in that kind of riff, but I kind of teed you up with some of the reasons of why do people get stuck, and then, you know, maybe the perceptions of the hero's journey beyond, you know, getting a handle on your addiction, let's say.
Well, those are large and compelling questions, and I know they require a longer discussion, but I concur with you. At heart, most of our decisions come out of our fears or our anticipation of issues, which is really the difference between fear and anxiety. And everybody, I would say, has addictive patterns. Addictive patterns are reflexive responses designed to lower the internal distress, whether we're aware of it or not. And you gave some good examples. Whatever the behavior is, and as you said, sometimes we use those words to describe drugs and alcohol and cigarettes and so forth. And they are overt in their negative consequences, but there are many other addictive patterns. And, you know, when kids, particularly adolescents, have their cell phones taken away for any reason, they go through addictive withdrawal. They have enormous irritation, anger, anxiety, yep, and then depression. And we're creating an addictive culture here. And it's you know, seemingly something without consequence. But in fact, you use another good phrase, self-soothing. You know, when the infant sucks its thumb or holds onto its blanket or its ratty old toy, it's not saying, you know, this is my mother, because it knows better. It's saying in a world where I'm relatively powerless in a large and uncertain universe, this is the only thing I can return to that gives the hint of solidarity, that's acceptable, that's available. It has a momentary effect. And since it's momentary, you know, it has to be repeated. And that's the addictive hook. The irony is we all have addictive patterns. And one of the ones, and I'm certainly as guilty as the next person of this, is habit. We try to impose on the newness of every day, the radical otherness of each moment, pattern in the interest, once again, of its being manageable, controllable, predictable, etc. Do you notice how out of sorts we get, even anxious and stressful, even angry, if the newspaper's too late or the traffic's heavier and you're going to be late for that appointment? You know, things that are not cosmically important, but the level of response is disproportionate. And then you realize it's not about what it's about. Well, what is it about? Well, I'm thrust back into that uncertain and unpredictable universe is what it's about. And so people get attached to their self-soothing systems. And, you know, it's easy to see it in the outer world with, you know, behavioral issues, but intrapsychically, where do we repeatedly go to sort of deal with our distress? And, you know, even something like meditation or prayer or behavioral responses of some kind can be addictive in character. And I'm not using that word judgmentally. I'm understanding this as a central aspect of the human condition again. But where we're stuck, and we also all have stuck places, some of them are very large stuck places and some are some smaller ones in consequence. But a stuck place occurs when pushing against it, not doing what we would characteristically do at that moment, begins to stir up the anxiety that is cooled in our basements, our psychic basements. And because we feel that stress, we turn to the addictive pattern. To give you a silly example, let's say while we're talking here, we're so absorbed in what we're conversing about that we don't notice the water is rising in the room in which we're sitting. But our whole system will know the difference. It'll respond. And let's say I make some gesture. I move my arm in a certain way, and the water goes down. Well, I don't even have to become conscious of that. I've just invented an addictive solution, and I put solution in quotes there.
Yeah.
This behavior allowed the distress level to retreat for a brief while, but then it begins to rise again. So then I turn to that gesture again, perhaps unconsciously, but in time it becomes an ingrained habit. That's why I say our habits, even the idea of imposing habit upon, you know, the moment of freedom that every life brings us or every day brings us, is itself an addictive pattern. So ultimately, the culprit here is anxiety. What is it that is triggering your anxiety? If you could face that and not do the behavior, then you've taken a step into a larger psychological and spiritual place. You're no longer a prisoner, because people become, understandably, prisoners of their anxiety management systems. And they become, you know, part of the operation. It's part of our internal operation system. And that's why they're so hard to break. And as you said, you moved away from alcohol, but you moved maybe to your cell phone.
Yep.
And you say, well, that has fewer consequences. And that's perhaps true. And yet I think you were also saying, I recognize there is something there that, again, it's not about what it's about. It's not using the cell phone as an instrument of communication or of information. It's a management system. And I feel distress when I don't manage it. So that's why addictions are so hard to break. You have to be willing to face what it's a defense against. The ability to do that takes time and courage and sometimes support from others. But if you can, you can break the tyranny of the addictive cycle. That doesn't mean you're going to be free of anxiety. That comes with the human condition. You know, we are creatures who can imagine possibilities, and some of them negative possibilities. And that's built into our DNA. You know, if you didn't imagine that the tiger you're approaching could be harmful to you, then you just right walk up to it and just pat it on the head. And that would probably be a career mistake.
Right. Yeah.
You know, yeah. And so we have to be able to imagine the possibilities. And it's in the imaginal world, not imaginary, but in the world of image, intrapsychic image, the imaginal world, that we have our systems at work. And that's why I would say none of us is free of addictive patterns. If you look most carefully at how you actually organize your life and what happens, what do you reflexively turn to when life gets very stressful?
Yeah, that's great. You know, I couldn't help but, you know, I saw your book about men under Saturn's shadow, the wounding and healing of men. Okay. And so naturally I had to grab that. And I just wanted to ask you, like, what is the primary male wound? And how does it relate to Saturn? You know, my listeners, that's probably a very new concept. You know, I've done, you know, some like you, I've done some rabbit hole research on, you know, Saturn's imagery and astrological, you know, correspondence and, you know, but not to your depth, but, you know, for me, like, if you were to say, what does Saturn represent? I would say, well, to me, it would represent maybe a sense of fate or a sense of almost like a sense of limitation or heaviness. Uh-huh. Or maybe even corresponding with death or something finite. But I'll let you take it from there. Like, why is Saturn included primarily in that title? And then how does it relate to the male wound?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, I think you're the first person to ask me specifically about the title. I wasn't thinking astrologically, but your adjectives that you just employed were applicable, because my source was the ancient Greek myths about the foundations of the universe. Hmm. What was fascinating was that the male gods invariably were competitive, invariably were trying to kill each other. They were invariably jealous of each other. They got caught in the power complex. And So, you know, one God slays his children, and so the children have to slay that God, you see, and the whole Saturnian weight, the gravity of this legacy means that, you know, first of all, you're bound to and defined as a male by those roles that we were referencing a few moments ago. Mm-hmm. And secondly, that, you know, you're caught in a competitive universe. You have to take something away from that other guy before he takes something away from you. And it creates this insane culture that's gone on for thousands of years of winners and losers, you know, and this sense of hierarchical values. Rather, one of the things women found out, and I think they perhaps had to survive, was the element of cooperation. We're better off when we cooperate with each other, when we work toward common goals and support each other in that process. Mm. The world of competition that men grow up in, and I felt it as much as the next person, is one of isolation. One of the phenomena that I experienced having written the book Under Saturn's Shadow was many men wrote to me and said, you know, I always thought there was something wrong with me because I had other feelings. I had other thoughts. I wanted to live in a different way, but I felt so judged. I felt so isolated. I felt inadequate. And the worst wound for men is a horrible isolation. Most men are psychologically isolated. And I had, you know, fellows write to me from the Australian outback, you know, I mean, literally from all around the world. And I could tell that, for one thing, I was trying to normalize their personal experience. But secondly, to speak to that question of loneliness. And I think man's greatest disease is he's being eaten alive by loneliness. And, you know, you can have a bowling buddy if you still bowl, or whatever, somebody at work you talk to. But generally speaking, men don't talk to each other the way women talk to each other, because of it built into a man. And you probably have been able to overcome this limitation in your men's group, but yeah, it takes a while to get there. But in a sense, what men think is, well, if I tell you about what's really going on inside of me, you're going to judge me. You're going to think me a lesser man, or even worse, you could use it against me. And of course, we've all had experiences of that happening. And I think that Saturnian dimension starts in the playground. I think by the time we're 5 years old, we've already learned to be wary of other kids on the block. Mm-hmm. And that isolation is one of the reasons that men die earlier. I mean, if you think strength is connected to longevity, well, women have won that battle for many years now, and the gap is actually increasing at this present moment in our culture. And secondly, again, that terrible isolation leads men to fall into those self-soothing behaviors we were talking about just a moment ago. You know, that's when, you know, a man has to go find another woman, or he has to go get stoned in some way.
Yeah,
or bury himself in his work, because, you know, it's a way of anesthetizing this terrible pain of loneliness. And so, you know, men have all had the experience of trying to reach out to another man and feeling it was rejected or judged. And so you say, well, I'm not going there again. And that increases the isolation and deprivation that almost all men feel in great amount.
Absolutely. Everything you're saying is spot on. You know, I had that experience, you know, of, you know, being in a long running men's group. God, it just was so needed for all of us. Like, we just got so much out of being in a group where we could unpack the things that men face. And, you know, I've often said, you know, before that, you know, it was not uncommon for a man, he could be diagnosed with cancer, his marriage could be coming apart, and he's got an imminent divorce coming. Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't mention it to his best friend at the bar. They'll talk about the Seahawks losing last Sunday, but the friend doesn't feel it to this man that he loves, his best friend, comfortable enough to say, I'm hurting right now. I am going through a bunch of shit. You can't even believe what's going on with me. He might try to mention it, you know, almost like sideways, but not comfortable just coming out. And you know, I've been blessed to be in men's groups where men will just say, you know, we do rounds where it's like, what's the high and the low of the week, right? And it gives men a chance to unpack. But you're right, like loneliness. And I wanted to ask you too, like, I grew up as an athlete. So I grew up in the competitive sports world. I played college baseball, and I just loved that world when I was younger. But as I've gotten older, I don't enjoy it as much anymore. Like, I still love baseball. Baseball is in my soul. You know, like, I just love the sport. I love all the nuances of baseball. But that underlying admiration for overly competitive alpha males has greatly diminished. As I've gotten older, I appreciate men that are comfortable in their skin, and comfortable in their skin means being honest that it's hard to uphold that alpha male front at everything. Like, it's just not truthful. And I know that every man has this sense of loneliness and stuff in the shadows, because I've sat in so many men's circles that I just appreciate that aspect of masculinity more than the projection of strength at all costs. You know what I'm saying?
Of course.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. And let me be clear. Wherever you see machoism, you see really a defense against fear. I mean, that's the dirty little secret, you know?
Yeah.
You don't believe the macho guy, because the guy who feels his own center doesn't have to act that way. It's the guy who has no center that has to act in a powerful persona of some kind. Mm-hmm. Because when men get together, you know, you mentioned the guys at the bar, you know, there are two topics of conversation going to be politics and sports. And why? Because it's out there. You see, it's out there, not in here.
Yep.
It's out there, it's safer, and we can agree or disagree. You know, you like the Seahawks, I like the Eagles. So, okay, we even have a bet on the season here. So there you go. And it's all out there.
Yeah.
The kind of questions you and I are addressing here are never touched. And that's why it's kind of like going to a physician for an annual checkup, but don't tell him what's hurting inside, you know? If you don't, it's going to metastasize, and it does. Into depression, self-abuse of various kinds, addictions, and again, this often deep, deep disdain for one's own soul, you see. So, you know, men are in trouble, and especially in a culture of changing roles, because in the past, they could also identify with their roles and so forth. And
sure.
One of the things I found in therapy is, you know, in every man, whether you know it or not, is a mountain of anger, first of all, because his soul has been violated. He may or may not understand that, but his psyche does. And secondly, is a lake of tears. And it's rare for a man to weep in therapy, but I would say 95% of the time when men have had tears come to them, it's not about the breakup of their marriage. Sometimes they will if they've lost contact with a child or something like that. But 95% of the time, it's when they start talking about their dads. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it comes up. And what almost invariably follows, and this is very sad, they start apologizing. I'm sorry about that. As if that's something to apologize for.
Yeah.
You know, one of the chapters in the book Under Saturn Shadow is about the father hunger. We have a deep abiding need for a male nurturing father, and a father who's a teacher and exemplifies what we need to know about being a man. And of course, there's an awful lot of men estranged from their fathers, or their fathers are missing altogether, or maybe present in the room, but not present emotionally. And so there's a gap there, a lacuna in one's formation. And so this deep hunger, because our ancestors, you see, had a clear understanding. Of course, their midlife crisis was at adolescence, you know, around 12, 13 or something like that. And they were not initiated by the personal father, but by the wise elders. It was like the fathers, the archetypal fathers, were the source of wisdom and training for them. What we say to a young kid today is, you know, go to college, join the army, whatever, pick up some computer skills. That's sort of what it's about. Make some money. Well, that doesn't touch to your human nature. It doesn't touch the needs that you have for relationship and for purpose in your life. You know, it's sort of a kind of false advertising, if you will, which again is part of what perpetuates this Saturnian thing. What's Saturnian about it is it's such a heavy weight that every man carries. And all of us, myself included. You know, the funny thing is, this is very confessional, but I didn't write that book until I was around 50. And I was asked to do so because I had a colleague of mine, now deceased, Guy Corneau from Montreal, who had written a book called Absent Fathers, Lost Sons. He was talking about that father-son relationship. And he was coming to Philadelphia to speak. And I was living there at the time. And I was asked to give a talk in concert with Guy. And so I found myself uncharacteristically resisting addressing a subject, and I put it off and put it off. And I had to ask myself as a therapist, now, when a person resists something, why are they doing it? And the answer is invariably, it's because there's something scary there for them.
Right.
I thought, all right, so I have to address what is scary here for me. And what came up from within was a voice, so to speak, that said, but we don't talk about these things. I thought, whoa, where did that voice come from? And that's when I began to recognize, well, our life gets organized around secrets. And I realized, okay, I have to open the door to that. And then they started tumbling out. And that's what I made the focus of that book. It's about eight male secrets, one of which was that his life is more governed by fear than he's able to recognize or even make conscious for himself. And so much behavior is fear-based rather than generative. So, you know, we all have that kind of need and defense against the need. So no wonder we get screwed up because we're at odds with ourselves. You know, that's what this meant by a neurosis. It's not about your neurology. It's about the conflict of values going on inside of you. On the one hand is fear, and on the other side is the desire for a healthier life. And those two agendas are colliding constantly inside of a person. And they reach the surface as symptoms. You know, two trains on the same track, you know, run into each other, going to merge to a third. And the third may show up in your marriage or in your career or in your patterns of self-abuse or wherever. But never goes away. It goes somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
From an analytic standpoint, when a person comes into therapy, and by the way, the word therapy means simply to listen to or pay attention to, and psyche is the Greek word for soul. So psychotherapy literally means pay attention to the soul. That is to say, that deepest, most meaningful part of who you are, your source and your directive. And if that keeps getting run over by the world around you or by your own behavioral patterns, you know, then you're going to be in trouble. And then it's not about the marriage. It's not about, you know, your depression per se. It's about something else that needs to be addressed here. And that's an open invitation for healing. And sadly, not every man recognizes that or has the courage to undertake it. But when we do, then the world begins to change. And we begin to recognize that there is a center within us that knows what is right for us. I put it this way. We all need to understand there's something inside of me that knows me better than I know myself, and that it has my well-being in its agenda. And I need to pay attention to that. You know, what is, you know, in some way, and this is an overgeneralization, but I think it has truth. The agenda of the first half of life, what's the world want from me? And how do I mobilize enough strength to meet that head on? You know, how do I find my personal path vis-a-vis my parents' expectations or the culture's expectations or the partner's expectations? Second half of life is a different question. What is wanting expression through me? It's not necessarily about me fitting in. It's about embodying something that is unique to each person, and each person has a life to live. And it's not just to fit in and be a social creature. We are social creatures, but we're also more than that. What is the soul asking of you? And, you know, to just give you a quick personal example, I would never have thought as a child that I would spend, you know, the second half of my life listening to people with their suffering. And at the same time, I can't imagine today anything more powerful or more meaningful to me than to share the journey of individuals, because we're all on this common journey, albeit with different pathways through it. As a young person, I thought, you know, I want to be a Major League Baseball player, but I didn't get that body. Mickey Mantle did, you know?
Yeah.
And then I became an academic, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And I've always identified with teaching because I revered my teachers. They opened a larger world for me. But I came to realize, too, that in the first half of life, I was trying to escape the reality of these questions by living the life of the mind. It was a rich and powerful time, rewarding time, but it was also in some way avoidant.
Yeah.
And that's why I was personally blessed, and I wouldn't have thought so at the time. I was blessed by a midlife depression, which is what took me to my first hour of therapy long ago. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it caused me to change my career. And so the second half of life has been, I think, dealing more with the reality and with the questions that the child had that we began with today.
Yeah.
So I think each man has an appointment with himself or with his own soul, and not everybody shows up for the appointment. And that's very sad when that happens.
So you and I both fell short of our major league dreams, Jim.
Oh, yes. Well, I keep waiting for the Eagles to call me and say we need a, because I played some football in college, and it's like I keep waiting for them to call me and say we need a DB here, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The call never comes through, so there it is. You know?
You're still waiting. I get it, you know. You know, mm-hmm. You wrote something in one of your books. I don't know which one. I didn't jot that part down, or I couldn't read my writing when I went over to make the questions, but it was really interesting. I don't know if I've ever read something quite like this. You said something about knowing which voices are from culture. You're talking about internal voices. Which internal voices are from culture? Which voices are from family origin? And which internal voices are from my soul? Mm-hmm. I thought that was a really interesting question. And I guess I just wanted to ask you, like, how do you discern? Like, to me, sometimes there's this internal dialogue. I think I'm zeroed in on what my soul wants, but maybe also I'm maybe picking up signal from family origin or from culture. They can all kind of sound like this intuitive whispering. And how does a man or woman go about kind of making sense of what is soul and what belongs to culture, or maybe even that middle ground of what belongs to family origin? And I remember, just to give a quick story, that when I did quit drinking 11 years ago, that was a voice of my soul asking me to move past a certain behavior. But I could also feel my deceased grandparents, that it had an impact on the family soul, that it made a difference to my grandparents that were alcoholics, that I finally took this step of healing that part of myself. I could feel whisperings in the family story as well. So there was some overlap there for me on that. But I guess I just wanted to return to the original question, is how do you discern the voices and maybe even attune to the soul, or attune to a frequency that where you might receive messages that are important to you?
Well, that's the $64 question. Going back to an era where $64 meant something. But discernment, that's the right word. Discernment means sorting and sifting over time. Because in any given moment, you could be in the grip of a complex of some kind. And by complex, I don't mean anything necessarily pejorative. It's a complex is a cluster of your history. You know, you have positive aspects of your history and you have negative aspects of your history. Which one at any given moment has come up? Because when you're in a complex, you're in a state of possession. You know, once in a while, a person will stop, scratch his head and say, I wonder why I reacted that way, you know, or why back there did I make this choice rather than that choice? And you're right. There's an extraordinary amount of traffic going on inside of us at any given moment. And many times we respond to the loudest voice or to the old defense patterns. And it keeps us locked in. It keeps us caught in those behavioral traps. And so discernment over time, that's really the purpose of therapy. To you know, what might bring a person to therapy is their marriage or their depression or whatever. But what is more important is who is the person who's going to be making choices about these things? We have to sort through your traffic first, so that the choices you make are the ones coming from your own depth and your own, you know, life force. And, you know, that's a lifelong process because, you know, actually, I know it's referenced in the Bible where Jesus says you have to test the spirits. Where did that voice come from? Mm-hmm. I've often asked people who've made a choice of one kind or another or examining a behavioral pattern, what was that in service to inside of you? A choice we thought was maybe a good choice may have been an old codependence or a fear-based response of avoidance or a fear, you know, accommodation of a situation, you know, rather than an authentic choice. You know, I was raised, as many people were, and of course, this was compounded by growing up in the 40s in the Midwest and the 50s. To be a good child, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that ostensibly, but good meant, you know, your choices are the ones that fit in with the world around you, meet your parents' expectations, etc. Mm-hmm. Well, with all the best intentions, no one meant harm by that, but it also means this is not rising out of an honest conversation with your own soul. My path had to be different. And I think that's one of the reasons why I intuitively, once I was able to, left home and, you know, only returned for holidays and so forth, because I knew something inside had to find a different path. And I say that with love and respect to my parents, but I had to find in my way the answers to the questions that I referenced at the beginning today, because their answers were no longer satisfying to the soul. Mm-hmm. So each of us, as I said, has an appointment with our own soul, and it's not just once, it's repeatedly. And you have to decide to show up for that and not make impulsive decisions, but make discernment decisions, asking that question, but where is this coming from in me? Where have I been here before? What does that touch in my history? And sometimes a good thing is not a good thing, or even a good thing stands in the way of the better thing. And that's why it's a sorting and sifting over time. And I've seen that's how people change. You see, it's not just changing a behavior or an attitude or an outer relationship. That could be important or necessary or not, or it could be delusional. Because if I change my partners or I change my career, I'm still going to be stuck with myself. And wherever I'm limited, that's going to travel with me. So genuine change is a process to be referenced and thought about and reflected upon and suffered, frankly, over the rest of your journey. And, you know, I've often said, you know, sometimes we come up against circumstances that we just have to deal with. And the question then is, well, how now in the face of this situation over which perhaps I have no control, am I to live my life with integrity? You know, integrity rather than adaptation. You know, I mentioned earlier today at 84, I'm dealing with some, you know, serious health consequences and growing old and trying to be a good partner with my wife and stay alive in a inspirited way. It's a different arena. And so the question is, how now in the face of these circumstances over which you have no control, are you to live your life with depth, courage, and integrity? And that's a daily question. And I think about it daily. And the fact of thinking about it makes me a little more accountable. It makes me a little more likely to be aware. What happens is we get dulled by routine. Today's another day. Oh, it's Thursday or it's Friday or well, this is what I do today. And we become creatures of our roles. But who are you apart from your role? What is wanting expression through you? This is not narcissism. This is not self-absorption, because we always want to be conscious or at least reflecting upon the impact of our decisions or failures of decisions and their impact on other people. But you also are accountable to your own soul. At the end of the journey, Did you live your journey, or did you avoid that? Did you live someone else's assignment? You know, as Jung put it so succinctly, he said, life is a short pause between two great mysteries. Well, what is this pause? How are you to live it? What makes sense of it for you? And if your answers aren't your answers, then you're going to be living someone else's life. And that's not a good way to go. This is not a new problem. In 1885, Tolstoy published a novella called The Death of Ivan Illich. And Ivan Illich is a name in Russian like John Johnson. It was meant to be an everyman figure. And this is a fellow who, with good intent, lived all of his assignments. He married the right person, espoused the right career, lived in the right neighborhood, practiced the law in the right way, became a judge, etc. And then suddenly there's a pain in his side that doesn't go away, and he learns he has a terminal illness. And he realizes for the first time, this hasn't been my life. He's never had an honest conversation about this with anyone. And in the end, everyone turns away from them because they're caught up in their preoccupations and they don't want to deal with these things either. And his last 3 days of his life, he has a conversation about what's life about and how have I lived my life with a peasant who's been assigned to him as a caregiver. And, you know, why would Tolstoy have written that novella in the 19th century unless he'd seen that phenomenon all around him there?
Yeah.
So this is why we say we're not our roles. Your role could be good or bad, but you're not your role. It's like, what is ultimately the life force asking of you? That is not a narcissistic question. It's a demanding imperative that actually could be frightening. And at the same time, it gives your life a sense of purpose and meaning. And if it's right for you, it will be confirmed from inside, not necessarily from the outer world, but from inside. Most of the people that we would admire in history had difficult lives, sometimes even lives of martyrdom. I mean, one of my few heroes is Nelson Mandela, who had his, you know, adulthood taken away by an unjust system. And when he came out and had access to the instruments of power, could have been understandably full of rage and revenge. But instead, he rose above that to try to heal his nation. And I have enormous admiration for the courage and the sort of spiritual integrity that that took of him. And I haven't faced the obstacles he faced, but I also respect the fact and ask myself, how is it that I'm to face that in my quite separate journey?
That's beautiful. Man, there's so much there, so much wisdom. I just so appreciate it. You know, I feel like we could sit around the campfire and chit chat about all the stuff we care about, but I want to be respectful of your time. Your books are all over the place on Amazon. Is there any other place that people can find you and your work that you prefer to send them? And then you said you have a new book coming out. When is that coming out? And what's the topic this time around?
Well, the next book is called Living with Borrowed Dust, D-U-S-T. Strange title. I don't have conventional titles, as you may have noticed. But
yep, I have. Yeah.
It's taken from a line from the poet Stanley Kunitz, who wrote this in old age. He said, I only borrowed this dust. So it deals with the theme of happiness. What makes us happy? And are we supposed to really seek happiness, or is meaning more important than happiness? And is happiness a byproduct, you know, of having lived in concord with our own souls? And that's the first chapter. And there's a chapter in there on aging and how we approach working with our dreams and, you know, dealing with fears and that sort of thing. And there's also a chapter there on the divided American electorate, looking at it from a psychological rather than a political standpoint and so forth. So it's due in March of 25. So I hope to be here in time to see it. So we'll see. You know?
Absolutely. Well, Jim, thank you so much for coming on Basecamp for Men. I so appreciate your insight, your wisdom, all your experience and your storytelling. Just fantastic. And just thank you again for taking time with us today.
Well, it's a privilege. And part of my soul's work is to be a vehicle, as all teachers are. And so I appreciate the work you're doing as a conduit for particularly for men to begin to look at their own lives in a different way. And that has the potential for profound healing, not only of those individuals, but for the culture in which we live and the families that we are caring about. So thank you in turn.
I'd like to thank Jim for his kind blessing at the end there. If you enjoyed the episode as much as I did, you can go get any of Jim's excellent books. Three of my favorites are 1, The Middle Passage, From Misery to Meaning in Midlife. 2, Living Between Worlds, Finding Personal Resilience in Changing Times. Great book for the times that we're in right now. And 1 for the men, titled Under Saturn's Shadow, The Wounding and Healing of Men. Thank you, base campers, and we'll see you around the fire next week. If you find value in our show and wish to show us some love, we are now making that very easy to do. You simply go to www.basecampformen.com and click on Donate Support Basecamp. You'll find an easy way to make either monthly donations for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate just once. We love the monthly donation and hope to build this up over the coming months, but any show of support is greatly appreciated, honestly. Thank you for your support and for helping to keep Basecamp as a resource on your hero's journey. That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. Men, good luck in all your endeavors and good luck on your hero's journey. This is Tony Rizak, and you're listening to Base Camp for Men.